We know as American citizens what that means. The impact on your life when your life is not valued by the state means that your life can be taken away. There is no accountability if that happens, and that indeed is the case for Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Children have been detained as young as 11 years old, and many of those detained, as we've documented, have been subjected to force in detention, including choking, use of stun grenades, and threats and interrogations without the presence of parents and a lawyer.
Growing up seeing friends being killed in front of me, seeing people, seeing brains on the floor, growing up breathing tear gas in an environment of violence and fear and hearing bullets every day. In 2011, I lost one of my best friends, and obviously it was the beginning of a series where every 3 years I would lose a friend.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and as always, there is so much we could focus on this week. James Comey, a big win for labor in the U.K., the Left Forum in New York City, the murder of Richard Collins by a white supremacist right here at the University of Maryland, the fight to save Medicaid and the Consumer Protection Bureau, and a huge grassroots coalition here in D.C. fighting for funding of legislation called the NEAR Act, which emphasizes and treats the root causes of community violence, including poverty, homelessness, unemployment, and trauma. But this week in June 2017 marks 10 years of Israel's blockade of Gaza, 50 years of Israel's military occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, 70 years since the Nakba and ethnic cleansing of Palestine following the partition of the land against the will of the indigenous people, and 100 years since the Balfour Declaration, which set the stage for the Zionist movement to colonize Palestine and later establish a Jewish state. Organizations across the country and world stage actions this week to demand an end to Israel's brutal occupation as part of a commitment to justice for all Palestinians, whether in Palestine or in exile. One action by Defense for Children International Palestine was a congressional hearing held Thursday on Capitol Hill, that's yesterday, a hearing that might be more consequential than the hype James Comey hearing, given the fact that the U.S. is giving $38 billion in military aid to Israel over the next 10 years. That's our tax dollars. So, speaking on the lives of Palestinian children living under brutal Israeli repression are Omar Shakir of Human Rights Watch, Brad Parker of Defense for Children International Palestine, Yazan Mekbil, a student at Goshen College, and Nadia Ben-Youssef, director of the Adala Justice Project.
Thank you all for joining. My name is Omar Shakir from Human Rights Watch. This week marks 50 years of Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Golan Heights, and Gaza Strip, making it, according to the International Committee for the Red Cross, the world's longest sustained military occupation in modern history. Reflecting this week on the magnitude of 5 decades of Israeli occupation, the UN Coordinator for Humanitarian Aid and Development Aid, Robert Piper, declared that the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories is the most long-standing protection crisis in the UN's history. Here in the United States, this occasion has passed with hardly any mention, despite recent warnings by public officials and others about the urgency of the situation on the ground. Just in October, the State Department warned that Israel's decision at the time to build new settlement units marked, and I quote, "another step towards cementing a one-state reality of perpetual occupation that is inconsistent with Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here today to tell you that the scenario that the State Department and President Obama spoke of is not some hypothetical future scenario, but rather a description of the current reality on the ground that has been the case for much of the life of Israel's occupation. Israel has sustained its occupation through repression and systematic abuses of the Palestinian population's rights. It today maintains its occupation through an entrenched system of institutional discrimination against Palestinians in the occupied territory. Many of these abusive practices, of course, as many of you are aware, have been justified in the name of security. Indeed, Palestinian armed groups have carried out scores of lethal attacks on civilians and launched thousands of rockets on Israeli civilian areas in violation of international humanitarian law. However, Israel's repression extends far beyond any security rationale. At least five major categories of violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law characterize this occupation, each of which has profound implications for Palestinian children. And I'll go through each of those categories in brief. The first, unlawful killings and war crimes without accountability. In the last Gaza war alone, in July and August of 2014, Israeli forces killed at least 2,100 Palestinians. The UN identified over 1,500 of those as civilians and over 500 as children. Many of these attacks, according to investigations carried out by Human Rights Watch, constituted violations of international humanitarian law, and some even war crimes, including the apparent targeting of civilian structures. Human Rights Watch, in the last year, interviewed a family from the refugee camp of Qalandia in the occupied West Bank that has lost three of their sons, each to excessive force used by Israel. In 2001, 11-year-old Yasser was shot while throwing stones. The Israeli Defense Forces carried out an investigation and found that forces had adhered to firing guidelines. 40 days later, their other son, 15-year-old Samer, was killed, also on the claim that he was throwing rocks. No one was held to account. 14 years later, their 17-year-old son, Mohammed, was shot from a distance of 10 meters away as he ran away from an Israeli jeep. The failure to hold perpetrators of serious crimes to account, whether it be on the Israeli or the Palestinian side, has unfortunately been a characteristic of 5 decades of occupation. In fact, B'Tselem has described Israeli investigations as, quote, a whitewash operation. The second category of abuse that Human Rights Watch has found characteristic or endemic of this occupation is illegal settlements and the accompanying discriminatory system. Israeli authorities have facilitated the transfer of their own civilians to the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, which is a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and a war crime. Today, there are over 580,000 settlers living in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, alongside well over 2 million Palestinians. Israel applies Israel's civil law to those Jewish Israeli settlers, affording them legal protections, rights, and benefits not extended to Palestinians living in the very same territory, who are subject to Israeli military law. Israel also provides settlers with infrastructure, services, and subsidies that it denies to Palestinians, creating a separate and unequal system of laws, rules, and services. And that's not just a term that Human Rights Watch used. Outgoing Secretary of State John Kerry used the very same term to describe treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories. So imagine this reality today. You can have a Palestinian kid and an Israeli kid who live 2 kilometers apart. If the Israeli kid commits a crime, he's tried in an Israeli civil court under Israeli civil law. If a Palestinian child 2 kilometers away commits a crime, he is tried in military court subject to military law. People living in the very same territory. And that discrimination, that institutional discrimination that has become endemic, extends to virtually every aspect of life in the occupied West Bank, including things like access to water and freedom of movement. The third abuse that we've documented is forced displacement. Now, this takes several forms. First, and most directly, is the expropriation of thousands of acres of Palestinian land, the theft of Palestinian land, for settlements and the supporting infrastructure. It also extends, though, to Israel's policy of arbitrarily excluding thousands of Palestinians from the population registry, which restricts their ability to live and travel in the West Bank and Gaza. Israel has also revoked the residency of over 130,000 Palestinians in the West Bank and nearly 15,000 in Jerusalem alone. Israel also imposes discriminatory burdens on Palestinians when it comes to permitting. So in nearly 60% of the West Bank, Area C, that's under exclusive Israeli control, it is nearly impossible for a Palestinian to obtain a permit to build a home. It's the same situation in East Jerusalem, which effectively forces families to make a decision. Either you leave your homes, or you build a home without a permit and risk home demolition. And indeed, Israel has carried out thousands of home demolitions on the basis of lacking a permit. Just last month, Human Rights Watch documented the case of Ashraf and Islam Fawaka from East Jerusalem, who were at the checkup for their one-month-old daughter when they got a call that their home had been demolished for lacking a permit. Today, their now two-month-old daughter, Aya, their four-year-old, Saba, their seven-year-old, Remus, and their nine-year-old, Ritaj, are residing in a tent alongside the ruins of their former home. The fourth category of abuse Human Rights Watch has documented is the Gaza closure and unjustified movement restrictions in the West Bank. In the West Bank, those restrictions take the form of checkpoints and the separation barrier, 85% of which is not built on the green line that separates Israel and the West Bank, but rather cuts and slices deep into the West Bank, which the International Court of Justice found to be a violation of international humanitarian law. In Gaza, for the last 25 years, Israel has tightened restrictions on the movement of people and goods. Although Israel withdrew in 2005, it maintains control of the airspace, the water space, the border, the entry of people and goods. It effectively runs Gaza as an open-air prison today. Next week marks 10 years of Israel's closure of Gaza, in which it effectively has had a travel ban on the entry or exit of any Palestinians from Gaza, subject to a set of exemptions. And even with exemptions, such as for urgent medical situations, it's been very difficult in practice for Palestinians to leave. In fact, the World Health Organization in December of 2016 found that only 41.7% of Palestinians that apply for a permit with an urgent medical situation were able to obtain one. Just in January, a 17-year-old, Ahmed Shubair, died of heart failure, having a congenital heart condition. He had been denied a permit to go to Israel for medical treatment just several months before. And the final category of abuse that Human Rights Watch has documented over the course of the life of the occupation is abusive detention. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been detained, the majority in military courts that have a near 100% conviction rate. Hundreds have been held hundreds annually have been held on average in administrative detention, based on secret evidence without charge or trial. Some have been held for doing no more than engaging in nonviolent activism. Israel detains Palestinian detainees from the West Bank and Gaza within Israel, which is a violation of international humanitarian law, and imposes onerous restrictions on family visits. And children have been detained as young as 11 years old. And many of those detained, as we've documented, and you'll hear more of shortly, have been subjected to force in detention, including choking, use of stun grenades, and threats and interrogations without the presence of parents and a lawyer. My final point I want to make is that after 50 years of occupation and decades of a fruitless peace process, it should be clear to everybody that downplaying rights will not ease the path to a solution. There's a need for us to take action on human rights and to have accountability, without which peace is simply not possible. In this country, we've held the two-state solution as a holy grail, but not because the situation on the ground, not because settlements are war crime, not because settlements are established on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians, not because settlements wreak havoc on the everyday life of Palestinians, not because of the system of institutional discrimination on the ground, but simply around the idea of separation. Any discussion of solution needs to be grounded in the reality of 50 years of occupation, repression, systematic abuse, and institutional discrimination. We need action. Let us not be here in 50 years bemoaning another 50 years of ugly, abusive occupation. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brad Parker. I'm an attorney and a national advocacy officer with Defense for Children International Palestine. What I'm going to try to do is focus in on what it means to be a Palestinian child living today in the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. What it means to be a Palestinian child living, growing up under the pressures of military occupation. To give you a sense of the context, the Palestinian population, it is an incredibly youthful generation. The majority of the population is under 25 years old. So when we talk about Palestinian rights, we talk about violations against Palestinians. We're talking about rights violations against children. Generations of Palestinian children grown up knowing nothing but occupation, repeated military offensives, constant settlement expansion, seeing the separation wall be built, cutting off their communities, separating their communities, separating their families from their land, from their livelihoods, checkpoints, closure, right? These are the things that have become inherent in 50 years of occupation against international law, as Omar mentioned, and have become pervasive, entrenched. This is the infrastructure that Palestinian children interact with when they interact with Israeli military occupation. It's not something that's intangible, right? There is a very physical presence in Palestinian children's lives for occupation. 2016 marked the deadliest year for Palestinian children in the West Bank in the past decade. We had at least 32 Palestinian children killed with live ammunition or crowd-controlled weapons fired by Israeli forces. In Gaza, children slip deeper into poverty. As the blockade begins its 10th year, many children are still living in protracted displacement. Equally alarming, ill treatment and torture of Palestinian children arrested by Israeli forces has continued unabated. Since 2014, Israeli forces have increased the use of live ammunition to squash protests. In 2015, we noticed this trend sort of with an uptick in violence and shootings, child fatalities, and then in 2015, it continued. So far in 2017, we've seen this trend continue. We've had 9 children that have been killed by live fire throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And international law mandates that the use of intentional lethal force can only be used when you're challenged with lethal force. And the Israeli standard that has been changed is much below that standard. In many of the cases, we found, and even Israeli investigations have confirmed, that children did not pose a direct threat at the time that they were shot and killed by Israeli forces. Yet, in 80 cases of kids being killed with live ammunition between 2014 and now, there's only been one indictment. I want to turn to ill treatment of Palestinian children arrested by Israeli forces and charged in the military detention system. Children, the majority of them that are arrested by Israeli forces, charged in the military courts, the charge that they're charged with is throwing stones. So the majority of children are arrested from their homes in the middle of the night. Right? Heavily armed soldiers coming into the home, banging on the door, gathering everybody in one room. If you're the 15, 16, 17-year-old boy on the list that night, your hands will be tied behind your back, blindfolded, and taken out of the home. You'll be put into a military jeep, likely transferred, maybe a military camp inside of a settlement, a near a settlement. And there you wait. So if you're arrested around 2 a.m., you might sit there until 6, 7, maybe even 8 a.m., waiting for an Israeli police interrogator to show up for his job in the nearby settlement police station. Kids eventually find themselves in that interrogation room. There's shouting, threats, physical violence, really everything you could imagine where you would have psychological or physical force coercion with the effort or with the intention of obtaining a confession or some type of incriminating statement that you could then put in a file and hand to a military prosecutor. 96 to 97% of Palestinian children are denied access to attorneys prior to interrogation. So they're bound, blindfolded, taken from their homes. Parents aren't informed where they're being taken. They essentially disappear for a 24, 48, 96 hour period where the interrogation happens. They're denied access to legal counsel. 3 out of 4 experience some form of physical violence during this period. And then they appear in a military court where they first see an attorney and their parents. For detention, we've seen a drastic deterioration of the situation for Palestinian children arrested by Israeli forces. Amid heightened violence in fall 2015, the number of Palestinian children detained in the Israeli prison system spiked dramatically. At the end of March 2016, 444 Palestinian children were in the Israeli military detention system. Two other pieces related to detentions, we've seen drastic spikes in the use of solitary confinement for interrogation purposes. So this is not kids being held in solitary or isolation post-sentencing, post-trial. This is pre-trial solitary confinement to facilitate interrogation. So kids are held in isolation, shuffled back and forth between prolonged interrogation sessions where they're often bound to a low metal chair in the middle of the room, questioned for hours on end. We've seen the use of administrative detention renewed in 2015. So this is a practice of detaining children and adults without charge or trial. I want to just share in closing sort of a recent experience that I think is unique and gets to the heart of the things that we document and the reasons that these violations continue and why the occupation continues. A week ago on Sunday, I was in the Israeli High Court with a Palestinian father whose son was killed on May 15, 2014 by an Israeli border police officer outside of Ramallah near Ofer Military Court in the West Bank. The boy was 17, his name was Nadim. He was shot around 1 o'clock and killed with live ammunition. We heard about the case, we went out and checked it out at the time when it happened, and we saw CCTV cameras on the building right where Nadim was shot. We ended up being able to capture the video from those cameras, release the footage showing that Nadim posed absolutely no threat at the time he was shot and killed with live ammunition. The initial story was the Israeli forces did not fire over any live ammunition, right? Only rubber-coated steel bullets were fired, so he couldn't have been killed by Israeli forces because they did not fire live ammunition. And this type of denial is sort of the core of the impunity that continues to be perpetuated when it comes to accountability for cases like this. The family, so Nadim's father, Siam, he, in an effort to prove, right, something that he already knew, that his son was killed with live ammunition, they exhumed their son's body several weeks after he was killed to have an autopsy done. The autopsy confirmed the injuries and the fatality was caused by live ammunition. There was metallic fragments in his body. And even then, right, the denial continued from Israeli authorities. Eventually, we built out a forensic video spatial analysis of the killing that pinpointed the specific individual that fired the lethal shot. Following that, there was an indictment. So this is the one case where there's been an indictment since 2014 out of those 80 cases. The indictment didn't come because there's some interest in justice, right? It came because there was sort of nothing that could be done to deny that this case was actually the facts that were presented. Fast forward, after a 2.5 year legal battle where Nadim's father and family have been working to with Israeli prosecutors to prosecute this case, the overwhelming video forensic evidence in this case that clearly shows Nadim's killer, right? I find myself with Siam sitting in the high court watching as oral arguments take place where you have the Nawar family essentially arguing against the prosecution who has a plea deal ready to be accepted with the individual that has killed his son. So to give a sense of the obstacles that Palestinians face in achieving any type of accountability, sitting there, it becomes very clear that this isn't necessarily about 50 years of occupation. This isn't about green lines. This is really about pervasive and entrenched denial that continues to perpetuate impunity, right? That denies Palestinians justice and equality, that denies rights, and perpetuates 50 years of occupation. So I'll leave it there.
Hello everyone, my name is Yazan Maqbel. I lived in the town of Beit Omar in Hebron, the West Bank, before I came to the U.S. in 2015. I will start by saying that the stories that you're going to hear are just, I'm kind of trying to put what Omar and Brad said into my own words and into use my own life and experiences to give you a sense of how it's like to be a child living in the occupied Palestinian territories. So first of all, I'm a refugee. I grew up in a house with 10 demolition orders because it's next to the Israeli settlement of Kerem Tzur in the West Bank. So we did not have any land, and my dad was kind of forced to build our house in that area. We received the first demolition order in 2002, and my dad started the long battle with the Supreme Court and with the other military courts to cancel that, or to obtain a permit, or at least to stop the demolition order. And of course, we did not succeed. He spent almost 10 years until we got the temporary order to stop the military order. Among the years, we received 9 more demolition orders, which meant that every single day I used to wake up hoping that, you know, my house is not demolished, and I hope that I can live here for more. So just living with the fear that the house where I grew up, where I had all my dreams and the crazy chases with my siblings, is just going to be gone someday. Growing up, seeing friends being killed in front of me, seeing people, and I'm sorry, but seeing brains on the floor. Growing up, breathing tear gas in an environment of violence and fear, and hearing bullets every day. In 2011, I lost one of my best friends, and obviously it was the beginning of a series where every 3 years I would lose a friend. His name was Yusuf Khleil. He was working with his family in the Safa area of Beit Omar, in their farmland, when an Israeli settler shot him. Then in 2014, Muhammad Joab Ref al-Arruq camp was also killed while he was observing what was happening at his refugee camp. He was drinking tea and smoking a cigarette, standing at the window of his second floor, of the second floor of their house, and he was killed by an Israeli sniper. I grew up imagining that all the children in the world just have the kind of similar action Bollywood type of life, thinking that they all have tear gas and bullets, and there are checkpoints they need to have. 3 IDs and I don't know how many passports and permits to move around, and they need to see the separation wall whenever they go to another city. They have to lose friends or be detained, or they have to live with a father who was detained when he was a child. In 2010, the Israeli forces went to my grandfather's house and they were searching for me, for my name and for my brother's name. So they went in after midnight, they destroyed all the furniture, and they asked for Yazan Maqbel and for Zain Maqbel. And my grandparents had no idea what was happening, considering the fact that I was a nerd. And I'm trying, I'm still trying to stay a nerd, but anyways, so it was finals week back in January of 2010, studying for my finals. And I woke up around 3 a.m. to just review my exam, and I had a science exam that day, and I heard sound bombs and tear gas grenades and just shooting that was in my grandfather's area, 10 minutes away from where we live. And then I just woke up in the morning again and went to school, and my uncle stopped me in the way and he said, what did he do? And he was laughing and he said, you're really dangerous. They're looking for you. And I thought he was just, a way of encouraging me to go to the exam and be fine. But I went home and I saw my dad He closed the door when he saw me, and he was on the phone, stressed out. And then 10 minutes later, he came to me and he said, there's something bad that really happened. And I asked him what happened. He said, the Israeli army wants to arrest you. At that minute, I know that I'm not throwing any stones, I'm not participating in any protests, and I'm not giving the Israeli army any reason, even as a child, to be arrested. So I spent a week sleeping. It was January, and usually when you're detained after midnight, in a lot of the cases, the Israeli forces won't allow you to put clothes on. They just take you, you go to the interrogation center, and that's it. So I slept with my shoes on, with a jacket, and just prepared that any minute, whether they knock on the door or they just raid in the house, I'll be arrested. I lived with that fear alongside with my brother Zan for a week, and then just thinking of the idea that I might be arrested was terrifying. At that time, it was the first time when my father told us about his story of being a 15-year-old detained at the first during the first Palestinian Intifada in 1987. My dad was 15 years old, a nerd hoping to be a chemist. He used to love soccer, and he just went to school, went back home, and he tried not to get involved in anything, like even hanging out a lot with his friends, considering what was happening at that time. So he said he was arrested at the beginning when the Israeli border police came into the house. And they took him to the his high school that was turned into an interrogation center in Beit Omar. And he spent 20 days under interrogation, where he would stand up, and I want to perform this in front of you, where he would stand up every day for 8 hours at least, putting his hands up and lifting one of his legs. Every day for 8 hours. And that continued for 20 days. Then he was released, and just remember that he was 15 years old. He was released after 20 days for the lack of evidence. At that time, he did not participate in any protests, and he did not want to do anything, because at the end of the day, being in jail is the last thing a child wants to happen. But then he realized that whatever I do, whatever I'm studying, being at home, throwing stones, it doesn't matter. They're coming after me. So he started participating in protests, protesting the injustice and inequality of the occupation. Then when he was 16 years old, he was shot in the head, a live bullet that almost took away his life. He spent 6 weeks in the Maqasid hospital in Jerusalem, unconscious, and they almost announced his death twice. Hearing my dad saying these stories was a shock, because I didn't know that all of it happened. And then thinking that that could have been me was not an easy thing at all. And then he continued by telling us the second arrest story. When he was around 17 years old, he was arrested again from his house, and he was transferred to a Naqab prison, and he spent a year and a half in a Naqab prison living, and it's in the desert, living in tents, and he went on a hunger strike that was for 2 weeks. And again, he was 17 years old. Growing up with these stories and being a refugee and losing friends and having cousins and friends being detained and arrested every day, being detained and interrogated at different checkpoints, being afraid of being detained, just that idea of going to prison for nothing, I didn't do anything. It's just insane. And when I moved to the United States in 2015 for school, I used to carry my passport wherever I go. And every single time I saw a police car or a police officer, I freaked out. I tried to behave, even I changed the way I walk. I don't look at them in the eye. I try to avoid them. I change the street if it's necessary, thinking that it's the same. These are police officers. They have guns. And a lot of my American friends noticed that kind of strange behavior. Why do you even carry your passport? Especially that it's a Palestinian passport, and if I lose it, it's not easy to get a new one. So I told them, that's my background, and this is what the police officers usually do. And they told me, no, they're here to protect you, not to shoot you, or not to arrest you. Of course, after 2 years, that's not always the case in the United States. But as a guest in this country, I would say that I tried my best not to carry my passport around and just to smile whenever I see an officer. And until now, whenever I see the lights, I just freak out. Being here every day, I learn more that the life that I had and the life that my siblings and my friends had, I don't even know if I should call it life, to be honest, because it's we have a saying in Palestine that we are living because of the lack of death. We don't have any hopes. There is no future. We have to go through checkpoints, and we have a separation wall and settlements, and there's soldiers, and we have a military occupation. And it's really hard to imagine. A lot of people can't even comprehend the idea of having a soldier coming into your house after midnight with a mask on, with having a lot of, I don't know how many weapons, and it's just scary. When you wake up, and working with No Way to Treat a Child, I did the interviews with the kids who were showing the documentary, and Abdurrahman Jawabri said, just waking up and seeing that image of the soldier telling me, Habibi, which means sweetheart in Arabic, just get up, let's go, was not pleasant at all. And excuse my English, I don't know, I can't think of any word to describe it because it's really indescribable. However, despite all the occupation barriers, and despite all of the pain, killings, and the daily arrests, and despite our daily life as Palestinians, I was in Palestine over my winter break, and I had a lot of discussions with my friends who proved to me that they're really growing up and they're really reading about Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and they're reading the stories of the civil rights movement in the US, about South Africa, and they're trying to find a solution. They're sick of having these long, I think, useless negotiations. They're sick of having politicians who are not representing them, living under military occupation, and considering the regional instability in the Middle East and what's happening in Syria and everywhere. It's really hard to imagine a solution. Two-state solution, a one-state solution, a no-state solution, there is no solution at all. So just having that idea of we all have a dream. Martin Luther King had a dream, and I'm hoping that he could achieve at least part of it. As Palestinians, we all have a dream to be free, to live like normal human beings, not to be afraid whenever we leave our homes, not to be scared that I'll be killed or I'll be detained, and just to have water games at least. Václav Havel of Czechoslovakia, he was the first president of Czechoslovakia after the Soviet Union. He had this idea of living the lie. We think that what we have is good. We think that our daily lives are fine, and we think that everybody else is living the same as we are. Coming to the United States and seeing the other face of what being a child could be woke me up to live the truth and to notice and to realize that I really was, it's not just the occupation of land, not the having 10 demolition orders, but it's also the killing and murder of my own childhood, the killing and murder of two of my friends, and the detention of my father that destroyed his future and forced him to leave school. I'm sure that after this, a lot of us will go back to our daily lives. Maybe if you have children, we'll just play with them, walk with them. I just want you to remember that it could be your child, it could be your brother, it could be your sister. And living in the US does not mean because you are away from it, it doesn't really affect you, because it doesn't a lot of us. So this is a shout out to all of you, and this is a request from a Palestinian whose his childhood was taken away from him. Please do something. Please do something. Thank you.
Thank you, Yazan. Thank you to the organizers. Thank you all for being here. My name is Nadia Ben Youssef. I'm the director of the Adela Justice Project, and I have been working for the last 7 years with Adela, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. And this is why we're here, to listen to Yazan's story, to think a bit beyond crude figures and statistics that often rule our decision-making. In fact, we are here because of Yazan. We are here because of Youssef and Muhammad. This is a human issue. It's a human issue. Politics is a human issue. We are lawyers. We'll talk a bit about the legal regime and the legal system, but we are talking about human beings. And this is an urgent issue because of that. 50 years. What was happening 50 years ago? Yazan's father wasn't even born 50 years ago. This is a human issue. I'm going to talk and contextualize the occupation and bring us back a little bit into the historic depth, the legal regime that governs people's lives. But as I speak, remember that we are talking about people's lives. 50 years of occupation, but it didn't happen in a vacuum. It didn't just emerge out of nothing. It is grounded in history. It's grounded in history, it's grounded in a historical and a legal context that predates the occupation, that predates 1967, as often these issues do. There's a historic debt that we have to be committed to uncovering and to understanding, because if we don't understand the problem, how can we possibly understand the solution? So the occupation is often understood as this blight, this anomaly in the history of Israel, emerged potentially, if we are at our best, acknowledging that it's problematic, that there are violations that are happening, but it's distinct from Israel, it's distinct from the legal and political regime of the Israeli government. It's over there, something bad is happening, and it's completely different and disconnected to Israel, which is known as the only democracy in the Middle East. It's understood as founded on principles of equality and justice, and that is simply not true. So I want to bring us back to 1948. And I actually also want to shout out a curriculum that might be useful that's being launched this summer by the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. And it looks actually at the breadth of this history under the idea of 100, 70, 50, 10, 100 years since the Balfour Declaration in 1917, 70 years since the Partition Plan of 1947, 50 years of occupation and 10 years since the siege on Gaza. This is a history. But I'm going to talk about 1948 because it's critical and it grounds a lot of what I'm going to be talking about, particularly with regard to Palestinian citizens of Israel and how that connects to the occupation. The occupation is an outgrowth. The occupation is a symptom. We're going to begin the story in 1948. And it's called the Nakba. And I want you all to remember that name, write that name, say that name, Nakba, N-A-K-B-A, the Nakba. It means catastrophe in Arabic. And it refers to the founding of the State of Israel, the dispossession of Palestinian land, the displacement of around 750,000 people, the demolition of 500 villages, the catastrophe. What happened in the Nakba really grounds our understanding of what's going on both inside Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territory. Because the Nakba set up a legal and political regime that critically privileged the rights of certain people on the basis of who they are, subjugated, conditioned, or suspended the rights of others on the basis of who they are. The legal regime of Israel that was established in 1948 was premised on this idea that the Jewish people were deserving of more rights than any non-Jewish person that was living in that land. Israel was established as a Jewish state to privilege the rights of Jewish people. The Nakba occurred, 750,000 people became refugees, including Yazan's family. 150,000 people stayed, remained on their land, remained inside this new Israel, this new Jewish state of Israel. Palestinians who remained on their land and ultimately became citizens in 1952, so just a few years later, became citizens. 150,000 people who now make up 1.3 million people, or 20% of the population of Israel. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. 20% of the population of this Jewish state that is premised on the basis that you must have greater rights. You are privileged with more resources. You are privileged with more rights on the basis of your identity. 1 in 5 of those citizens is not Jewish. How do you protect the rights of non-Jews in a Jewish state? Can you be both a Jewish state that privileges the rights of certain people on the basis of who they are and claim to be a democracy that guarantees equality for all? Does that make sense? We say it like so. We say it so easily. Obama says it. Our presidents say it. We say it in the corridors of power, a Jewish and democratic state. As if that makes sense. The ideas about what that means and what the impact is most visible in three areas. So I'm going to talk about three main areas and then close with a story, a human story, that ties, I think, a lot of these things together. In fact, I want to say one more thing about this history before I go into kind of how the legal regime was grounded. So we have, again, 150,000 people, right, who remained, became citizens. But what's critical here, and now ties us into the story of the occupation, is that from 1948 until 1966, 18 years, the first years of the establishment of the State of Israel, these Palestinian citizens of Israel lived under a military regime. Lived under a military regime. We've heard what that means. We understand what a military regime is. Permit restrictions, administrative detention, restrictions on freedom of movement, tanks, surveillance in your cities and on your streets and in your villages. It's an important date, right? Until 1966, they lived under a military regime. What happened in 1967? What are we commemorating now? The transfer of that military regime to the occupied Palestinian territory. And the systems of land confiscation and displacement that I'm going to talk about quickly were in practice first, and were practiced first on Palestinian citizens of Israel. So land confiscation. So the founding of the state really is about confiscating Palestinian land and concentrating that land into the power and into the hands of the state. So you had a number of land laws that justified that confiscation and ended up so that Israel now owns and controls 93% of the land of the state. So you have massive concentration and confiscation of land, dispossession of Palestinian ownership of that land. And as the state is established, there's a founding law that I think is quite critical, which defines how you maintain this Jewish nature of the state, which is called the Law of Return. Are you familiar with the Law of Return? The Law of Return, which allows any Jewish person anywhere in the world to automatically become a citizen of the state. The ingathering of the exiles, as declared in the Declaration of Independence. So the Law of Return should be understood as coupled, as yoked with, and this is how these laws work, the denial of the Palestinian refugees' right of return. Right? So any Jewish person in the world can automatically become a citizen, and any Palestinian who became a refugee cannot return to their land. Because the idea of the Jewish state is to maintain a demographic majority at ownership of the land and to maintain a demographic majority in the space of the land. So that means more Jewish people than anyone else in that land in order to maintain this idea of a democracy. We're tying demography, numbers of people, to the idea of democracy, which is quite important. So you have the confiscation of land, you have the demolition of homes. So what was happening in the Nakba continues to today. So as we're looking at figures from 2012 to 2014, 97% of home demolitions occurred in Arab localities. So if you remember the Nakba, 500 villages were destroyed, right? 500 villages, over 500. About 139 villages remained. So the remaining Palestinians were concentrated in those 139 villages. There has not been one new Palestinian village created inside Israel. Not one new one, but the population has boomed. So it's 150,000 people who are now 1.3 million people still living in 139 Palestinian villages. So you have huge overcrowding and concentration of people. And what has happened is because there's limits on permits and limits to the natural growth of these villages for various reasons, as Yazan said, people are building unauthorized buildings. Very difficult to get permits. There's no natural growth. There are no new places to live. So people who are having children and growing and there's natural growth have nowhere to go. They're building unauthorized buildings. In April of this year, a law was passed called the Kemenetz Law. that's trying to streamline the demolition of these unauthorized buildings, taking them outside of the court structure and saying you can just demolish them. If you see it, it's an unauthorized building, demolish it, there's no recourse in law. This is legalized and passed in 2017. So the confiscation of land, the home demolitions, that I hope resonates, because we've heard a bit about that in the occupied Palestinian territories happening inside Israel. So the confiscation continues, the demolitions are legalized, and the land regime continues to benefit Jewish citizens and deny the rights of Palestinian citizens. So the land regime is formulated in this way. Citizenship is similarly formulated, and I think that's critical. I told you that these Palestinians became citizens, were granted citizenship in 1952, but it's an interesting citizenship. It's a citizenship that's bifurcated into citizenship and nationality. Citizenship is Israeli, nationality is either Jewish or Arab. Your citizenship is Israeli, but your nationality is Jewish or Arab. Why? Because we have to find a way to distinguish so that we can allocate resources and allocate rights accordingly. So citizenship in the law has entrenched a hierarchy of life and a hierarchy of values. So the citizenship law of 1952. Last Sunday, Adela was in court defending a young man whose citizenship is about to be revoked. So something important is happening apparently in Washington on the idea of loyalty oaths. And in 2008, there was an amendment to the citizenship law that says you can revoke citizenship. Why? For a breach of loyalty. For a breach of loyalty. So these citizens who might seem to be unloyal or perceived to be disloyal to the state can have their citizenship revoked, and that's being used primarily and only against Palestinian citizens of Israel. It's prohibited by international law. Citizenship is conditional. Citizenship is conditional, and it leads us to what I think we've been talking about a bit now too in terms of accountability and impunity, and what is the impact when your life is not valued. We know that as American citizens, what that means, the impact on your life when your life is not valued by the state, means that your life can be taken away, that there is no accountability if that happens, and that indeed is the case for Palestinian citizens of Israel. From 2012 till 2016, around 90% of cases of police violence were closed, the vast majority without investigations. For extrajudicial killings and extrajudicial executions that Brad and Yazan talked about, indictments are so small to be zero. The indictment against Nadim's killer is such an anomaly in these situations. So indictments are zero. Since 2000, 48 Palestinian citizens of Israel have been killed by police, and there is no accountability for their deaths. When your life is not valued, your life can be taken away. When the law doesn't protect your rights and doesn't deem you to be equal, the situation is for Palestinian citizens of Israel, for Palestinians living under occupation, is the same. When your life is not valued, you can hold millions of people under a military regime. When your lives and your rights are not valued, you can be demoted in your citizenship. Your citizenship can be revoked. You can live for 10 years under a siege and blockade in an open-air prison. If your life is not valued, if the law doesn't protect your rights, then this is the situation. The occupation is a symptom of this problem. There's no right to equality in Israel, and I think you need to write that down and send that message to your decision makers. There's no right to equality in Israel. It's not enshrined in law. There's no such thing as the right to equality enshrined in law, because they cannot protect equality and protect privilege. You cannot both protect equality and protect privilege. The story that I want to close with is a story of Umm Hiran, and I think it brings all of these things together. Umm Hiran is an unrecognized village in the Naqab, in the south of Israel, Umm Hiran. It was established by military order in 1956. So the people were moved from their homes near Gaza to this place in Umm Hiran, where they lived for 60 years. But it was an unrecognized village. This is a phenomenon that's pretty unique to Israel. Unrecognized village means that it doesn't exist on any state map, even though the state established this village. There's no infrastructure, no water, no electricity, no roads. These are citizens of Israel. They've lived there for 60 years. In 2003, demolition orders were issued on all of the homes in Umm Hiran. We're talking about Umm Hiran and Nahtir, these twin villages. We're talking 1,000 people. Home demolition orders on all of their homes. The reason that the homes are being demolished is to establish a Jewish town called Hiran. Remember that name. Hiran, the Bedouin village, Hiran, the Jewish town. These homes are being demolished in order to establish a Jewish town on top of their ruins. Adala represented this case before the courts and went all the way to the Israeli Supreme Court. It was 13 years of litigation, challenging this notion that you could displace people on the basis of who they are and put on top of them other people with more rights, the better citizens. And we challenged that in the Israeli Supreme Court, and we lost. The court said, yes, fine, we gave you that land, but we can take it away. You are not the right kind of citizens. The court didn't say that. I'm saying that. But we can take it away. So in 2017, the demolitions began against these communities. 15 structures were demolished. 8 homes were demolished in Umm al-Hiran. I just saw it for the first time 2 weeks ago with Brad, and I was shocked to have seen it. I wasn't expecting it. What happened in 2017 is that before the home was being demolished, what happens is people are rushing to take their valuables out of their home. So this man, Yaqub Abu Gyan, 50 years old, a math teacher, the father of 13 children, took all of those possessions out of his home, his computers, his anything valuable that he could, and he put them in his truck, and he started to move away from the site, and the police killed him. The police shot at the moving vehicle. He was killed. His car veered into police, and the car killed a police officer. And immediately, the police said this was a terrorist attack. The man was ramming into the police officers. He was part of ISIS, and the public security minister, Gilad Erdan, immediately said, you know, this is, we are responding. He was killed. It was a successful stopping of a terrorist attack. And immediately the footage came out as well, which showed that the police fired first and he was killed before he struck the officer. But that culture of lying and the culture of impunity persists. And Yaqub was murdered. His children are fatherless and now living in a tent next to their demolished home. This is inside Israel. These are citizens of Israel. And this is a story of privilege, too. It's a story of inequality. It's a story that says that certain lives are more valuable on the basis of who they are. And these people, the citizens of Israel who are going to move into Hiran, it's critical to note, are connected to the settlements in Hebron and the settlement of Susia in the West Bank. And they're living now in a forest inside Israel, waiting for the entire village to be destroyed before they can move. This idea that there is a bad occupation and a good Israel, that there's a division of ideas and ideologies that distinguish the occupation from the inherent nature of a state that is founded on the basis that certain people deserve more rights on the basis of who they are, is a false notion. And so we have to, in our thinking of what the problem is and what our thinking of the solution is, center rights. Center, how do we protect the rights of all the people living on this land? And then emerge from there, the solution emerges from there. And so as my colleagues have said, the conversation is about rights. In order to end the occupation, you have to center the rights of Palestinians, you have to center the rights of people who are on that land, and demand equality, demand justice, demand freedom for all, and it's your responsibility. You must do it, we must do it. 50 years is not only enough, it is 50 years too many, and it isn't 50 years. It's a history of dispossession and a history of injustice, and I welcome all of your efforts to stop it. Thank you.
You were just listening to speakers at another congressional hearing held Thursday on Capitol Hill. 50 years of occupation and life for Palestinian children. You heard Omar Shakir of Human Rights Watch, Brad Parker of Defense for Children International Palestine, Yazan Mekbil, a student at Goshen College, and Nadia Ben Youssef, director of the Adala Justice Project. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. And that will do it for today's show. Thanks to Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, G.J. Floyd, Waheed Aaron, and our engineer, Mike Red Eagle Nacella. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Avaram. Keep raising your voice. Peace.